Well, initially I didn't lift the van because I wasn't sure what direction it was going in, and I was afraid of these Yaron Gomeshi supporters and haters against women like myself. So I thought it was better just to keep it in place, but it never sat right with me that I had to hide. And I always felt like the reason that I wanted to come forward was the reason I'm hiding.
The Gian Gomeshi sexual assault trial of February 2016 was one of the most high-profile criminal trials in recent Canadian memory. There were three complainants who acted as witnesses in the trial. One of them, Lucy Decouter, waived her right to a publication ban, and because of this, we had a more nuanced understanding of who she was and how the trial unfolded for her compared to the others. Complainant 1 in the Gomeshi trial was known in the verdict as L.R. Many observers of the trial will associate her with the love bug memory or the red bikini photo. Like her counterparts, her credibility and memory were called into question in the verdict that ultimately acquitted Gomeshi of all charges. It's difficult to distill who someone is and what their experience in a trial of this magnitude was like without hearing from them in their own words. Having waived her publication ban, Linda Christina Redgrave is now putting a face and a name to Complainant 1. We talked about her experience with the justice system, her thoughts on the trial verdict, what she wished she'd known before entering the judicial process, and comingforward.ca, her new website for sexual assault victims. I'm Rob Chernick. Meet Complainant 1, Linda Christina Redgrave. I suppose the first question I have for you is, when you look at women like Carla Ciccone and Reva Seth and Lucy Decouter, who had come forward not only with accusations, but with their names and faced a lot of criticism, I'm wondering what prompted you to decide to lift the publication ban on your identity?
Well, initially I didn't lift the ban because I wasn't sure what direction it was going in, and I was afraid of these Yaron Gomeshi supporters and haters against women like myself. So I thought it was better just to keep it in place, but it never sat right with me that I had to hide. And I always felt like the reason that I wanted to come forward was the reason I'm hiding. I felt like I was being shamed and blamed into hiding. But I do completely respect other women who keep their publication ban on, because it's not for everybody, and that's for sure. It's a personal decision, but me personally, I didn't feel I needed it, and I felt kind of stifled by it. But I was happy to have it, initially.
If we were to go back to 2014, what prompted you to come forward to the police with your accusations?
Other women. I was looking out for other women. I mean, I hadn't spoken to anybody else who had any dealings with them. I hadn't spoken to a soul other than the person who had given me the article saying that he had been fired, and this is why. I felt like I had to say something because it looked like there was a pattern, and I didn't know. I didn't know it wasn't just me, and I thought people needed to know. I didn't really want anyone to know who I was, but I wanted people to know that other people had had a problem, and I was one of them.
With all the other people who came forward to the media with accusations, did you think there were going to be more complainants ultimately than yourself and the two others?
Oh, I did. Yes. When it came down to three of us in the beginning, and then there were a couple more added, and there was five of us, I thought, that's it. It's not that I wanted, him to have all these charges. It's just that it just seemed that there were a lot more people out there who had a story to tell. And it just, showed me how hard it is to report and how there's a stigma around it. And the person reporting seems to get blamed and shamed. It's not a supportive thing.
I know that one thing that has come out is this idea that all you have to do if you're a complainant in a sexual assault case is show up to the police and tell the truth, and show up in court as a witness and tell the truth. Is it really that simple?
Oh, no, it's really far from simple. That's the fantasy, right? You go to the police, you tell the story, you're a witness, you go to court. The crown attorney is your lawyer, and life goes on. But in reality, when you go to report at the police station, what I'm hearing from people who are writing to me and from my experiences, it's pretty sloppy. It's a sloppy investigation. The victims are not read their rights. They're not given their rights. They don't get the information they need to get going forward. They're not told about, you know, when and if you're allowed to have a lawyer, should have a lawyer, that your statement that you make is going to be used in court, that everything you say is not confidential, even to the victim witness. There's so many layers. They just do not tell you. And I don't blame them. I just think that these policies and procedures are not enforced. So when you get there and you start the process, and as you go through it, as I did, I was hit with some harsh realities that came back to bite me.
Now, I know that you've said one of your first surprises was that the Crown Prosecutor wasn't your, quote unquote, your lawyer. It wasn't your advocate, but instead it was someone who advocates for the public interest and pushes the case forward. And I'm wondering if you could explain what it was like when you discovered that the Crown wasn't representing you in a way that they were going to be your advocate.
I found out, not actually even through them, through the police. I found out after I had retained counsel. And I wasn't going to retain counsel. I didn't think I needed to because I thought, I don't need lawyers. I have the Crown Attorney. But I went to see them just to see if there was something I was missing. And that's something I learned there, that he's not my lawyer. And you can't even speak about the case to him. You cannot speak about anything other than when is court, what are the procedures, those types of details that you could get from the police. It was kind of a shocker. And it's after I retained counsel, I started learning all the things that I never would have known, and how the little details are the big details. And it was really eye-opening. But I had thought that the Crown Attorney was my lawyer in court. But he doesn't, he'll tell you in your first meeting, which isn't for a while, that, oh, by the way, I'm not a lawyer and you're not allowed to talk about details to me. So you have the police who are not confidential with your details, and the Crown Attorney who can't hear the details, who listens to the details.
Most sexual assault complainants don't have lawyers, and it seems that the anecdotal reason for this is that it's often seen as sort of suspicious for them to have a lawyer. Maybe they're trying to hide something. But as you've said, you know, the police and the Crown, for instance, you can't tell them anything confidentially. How do you think the experience would have been different if you hadn't had a lawyer?
Oh, Lordy. If I hadn't had a lawyer, I wouldn't have been protected with my third-party records. I wouldn't have had any idea what cross-examination was like. It would have been awful. People criticized us and said none of them were prepared. They all had lawyers. Well, I think the third witness, whose name is protected, didn't have a lawyer other than for her third-party records. And Lucy's lawyer, I think, was a civil lawyer, but It was just, they taught me about Marie Hennin and her tactics and her method. And people said I seemed unprepared. But if they had known what I would have been like on the stand without, you know, having the guidance of my counsel, I wouldn't have lasted an hour. I lasted till the end. And I pat myself on the back for that. And I thank my lawyers because they told me how to get through it and what to expect. And how to listen very carefully to the questions. And I know I didn't do it perfectly, but I did it a whole lot better than I would have had I not retained them. And I, too, when I first went to see them, I was thinking, this looks bad, that I'm looking for a lawyer, like I have something to hide, as you were saying. But once I started getting advice from them and learning more about the procedures, I realized there is nothing wrong with getting legal advice. In fact, it's just plain wrong not to have legal advice.
What are some of the other things that you learned throughout your experience participating in the trial that you wish you'd known in advance?
Oh, I wish I had known about how making a statement works. I think it would have been better had I consulted a lawyer before I made my statement. I wish I had known all about the confidentiality, about what my rights were. The police had at one point had just asked me to come in and give the text messages over when it's, and I have it in writing. It is my right to not give them my text messages and have a lawyer appointed by the Crown for third-party records. It's, you do not have to hand over your information. That's something that they have to apply for. So I wasn't told that. I wish I hadn't gone to media first, but then I didn't know that I was ever going to go to the police. So it was kind of my red light to everyone, like, watch out, there could be a problem with this man. Things like that, because they used my statements to the media as if they were detailed explanations sworn under oath, and they seemed to hold more weight in court than my testimony under oath. And I couldn't understand that, because I'm pretty sure I was told what you say in court under oath is your story. But Marie Hennen seemed to like what I said to the media more. So I wish I hadn't have gone to the media. I wish I had retained counsel. Then I wouldn't have to, you know, rely on the police with their shoddy work to give me my rights and tell me the rules of the game.
The Toronto Police put out an active call for people to come forward, and you were able to be represented by a lawyer. And there was also, you know, some very public support and belief in your story. And I guess it's interesting because a lot of women who go through the justice system with a sexual assault complaint in Canada, they have none of those things. And I'm wondering, if it was difficult for you to go through it, having those advantages, I'm wondering, how do you think it must be for someone who has none of those?
Oh, I think it's awful. And I mean, it's a crime in itself. I think that's why I knew going through this process that I couldn't just take this kind of a hit and walk away and say, whoa, that was bad. It's the same fire in me that wanted to alert women to, hey, there's a guy out there who you may want to be careful with, is saying, this is wrong. This is not how you try a sexual assault case, and that women need to know what they're walking into. And that's why I started my website, which is still a baby, but I'm hoping to have resources and information so somebody can get an idea of what they're going into. Because I think if you have knowledge, you're at least starting out with more than I did. And not everyone will have a high-profile case where everyone will be calling her a liar publicly. I mean, that's a good thing. But it's difficult. But it's knowledge. You need knowledge to go into it. Just to walk blindly into a police station is pretty hard. And if you don't do it perfectly, because apparently it's supposed to be perfectly scripted every time, you risk just looking bad on the stand. But with that pilot project that they're starting in Ontario, it's at least an acknowledgement that sexual assault victims need something. They need some advice. So I'm crossing my fingers that this goes well and then it becomes just a, you know, commonplace. You're in a sexual assault, you get legal advice.
I'm wondering what it's like to see all of the details about yourself out there in the media and to have people commenting on it, but not knowing who you are. I'm wondering what that feels like and what it's like to see that unfold in the press.
It was one thing to have people commenting on it, not knowing who I was. And that was difficult. But then having them commenting on it, knowing who you are, is also very difficult. But I feel like now that I'm public, everyone knows who I am and my face, I feel that it's easier for me to fight back. I feel like I can get out there and say, wait a minute. I could do that with a publication ban, but I was at the rally after the verdict, and I'm wearing sunglasses, a hat, and a big hood, and I'm talking to a crowd with the microphone, and I just thought, I can't do this in a trench coat and glasses. I need to be able to put my face out there. I want people to identify with me as just a regular person, and people who have been writing into me have been saying just that. One person told me they actually went and reported an assault because of me and coming out. If I can help anybody, it makes me feel good. It makes me feel like I'm doing the right thing. The wrong thing in my heart would be to go through this and go, oh, that was awful, and then just carry on. And a lot of people said, well, you're under a publication ban. No one will know who you are. But I know who I am, and I know what I went through. And it's just so hard to be in that position when you want to fight back.
Do you think that now that people, you know, they see your face, they know your name, they know a bit about who you are, because, you know, there have been some harsh criticisms during the trial that have come out. Do you think that it's much less simple to criticize someone when you actually know who they are versus when they're a stranger?
No, I think it's just as easy to do that. But since I've lifted the ban, I'm getting much more support. So I've always had a small percentage, and I'm really happy it's small. I'd say about 5% of the people that reach out to me are haters. And I'm getting good at troll patrol and blocking and blocking the friends of the friends. And I have to put extra security on all my things. People are trying to hack me and all that. But I'm getting better at it. I've had to kind of go into a different place in my head and separate. At first, it was really difficult to watch people and listen to people commenting about me, because it's like, wait a minute, you don't know me. But I'm separating it now. I look at it just much more objectively, and I try not to personalize it. They don't know me. They don't know who I am. If they did know me, they probably wouldn't be saying what they're saying. They might be having a good debate with me. I did that in court when I was listening to the closing arguments and the verdict. Kind of had to separate. Like, I was just someone in the gallery listening to a court case. If you get too caught up in it, you could fall apart. So I'm getting good at the being objective, separating from the good and the bad, and just trying to keep on method.
Now, what would you say to anyone who's skeptical about the removal of the publication ban? Because, as I'm sure you know, there are some people who sometimes wonder if, oh, maybe that's an invitation to maybe get a book deal or to find some sort of notoriety. What would you say to that?
You don't need to be public to write a book. And I had thought of writing a book early on. I kept thinking, well, what can I do? And then I put that on the back burner, and I thought, no, I need something more immediate where I can reach out, because my mission was to reach out to women and men. There's a lot of men writing me, too. I'm actually really surprised. But if I had wanted this for attention or for, oh, look at me, I would have done this a long time ago. I would have done this for attention. I could have done it before during the trial. While we were in court, I could have said to the judge, can I please have my ban lifted? And he would have done it if that's what I wanted. But I purposely did not do this until after, and even after the verdict, I waited so that it didn't look that way. I didn't want it to be about me going through the trial. I wanted it to be about the trial and me focusing on the trial. Writing a book really has nothing to do with the publication ban or not. You can write a book under another name. This had nothing to do with that. And people who think that, think again. I could have done this a long time ago. That's what my purpose was.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that the public has about you?
That I'm a liar. That I'm a liar. I think what's happened is a lot of what I call group thinking, and people jump to conclusions about things without having anything to back it up. Things like the memory, things like how is somebody supposed to act after an assault, those are all not written in stone. There is no one way. There are many ways. But in these cases, they were all pretty similar. So they weren't different or odd. We weren't all liars. We didn't even know each other. And the other girls whose charges were dropped, they have very similar stories with similar type of contact, and we don't know them either. It's not unusual, but because somebody may not be in that or have had that experience, it's easy to quickly judge, you did this, therefore it equals that. Well, think of three other reasons why they might have done it. Or research, what trauma and memory are about, or research sexual assault and behavior. I mean, look at women who are married and get assaulted. They don't, you know, if they don't leave right away, they're not judged on it. So it's very complex, and I think it, people simplify it and say, oh, well, she did this, and it means that. It doesn't. It's complicated.
Turning to the verdict, you said in other interviews that it's not as much the verdict itself that bothered you most, but the language that was used. And I'm wondering if there's a certain part that bothered you most.
Well, in my case, the fact that my memory was called demonstrably false about remembering the car, and that because of that, he basically didn't believe anything else I said. But now, as you may have seen in the news, people have brought up that I was right about the car and that my memory wasn't wrong, and that the judge has actually made a ruling against me on a suggestion by Marie Hennen that he adopted as truth without having facts to back it up. So that has bothered me more than anything. It's not that, and the fact that he was so condescending, that he stereotyped after saying he wouldn't stereotype and then continued on to stereotype, that he didn't seem to give it much thought and consideration. It's like we were all just a bunch of little liars and wasting his time. It wasn't the verdict. I expected that. But it was the judge and the way he ruled. And now I think he's made an error. I think he has made, from what people are saying, is a legal error in his ruling about me, because he adopted a suggestion by Marie Hennen. Marie Hennen said he did not own the car I said until months later, but there was no evidence as to what he was actually driving, leasing, borrowing when I was with him. Because that was never clarified, that was never brought up with facts and evidence, he took a suggestion, threw out everything I said after that, and made a ruling against me as being demonstrably false and that I perjured myself, when now it's being circulated around that I didn't.
I think the thing that we need to clarify for the listeners is that the issue with the car, of course, is now that it's coming to light that it seems he owned a yellow Volkswagen. It just wasn't specifically a bug.
Yes. And when I saw the car, it was dark and snowy. And in 2002, 2003, the bug was just coming back. People drove mid-sized cars, usually silver, white, or black. So his car being small and bright yellow was outstanding. It was different. A man to own a small, bright yellow car was just not typical.
Looking back on your experience with the justice system, what did you need, or what do you need, rather, to feel that justice would have been served in this case for you?
I would need, from the police station, all the rules, all my rights, all my legal rights, you know, moving forward. I would need, in court, a much more even playing field, where I was represented in court with a lawyer, and that the accused has to speak as well as myself, so that people can ask questions and clarify things. I felt like it was just uneven, and that I didn't have a chance to say anything other than answer questions that were being thrown at me in a way that was meant to create a lie that didn't exist. And I wasn't able to change that, you know, what was being presented and say, wait a minute, no, because I'm not allowed to ask questions, I'm not allowed to argue, I'm not allowed to do anything but answer the questions. So I would need to be able to be validated and heard so that it's more fair and more just.
One thing I wanted to talk about as well was your website. Now you have comingforward.ca, and I'm wondering if you'd tell our listeners about what you hope to achieve with this new project.
Okay, well, like I said earlier on, when I started learning about what I was going through, all the, you know, little things being big things, and then I had thought, okay, I'll write a book, and then I thought, no, I need to reach out more. And my intention coming forward in the first place was to help other women. It wasn't anything to do with me, because as Lucy had said, there's no dividends. There is absolutely nothing in it for me personally to go through a court case and say this happened to me, if it, you know, especially as a lie. I don't understand why anyone would suggest that. So I thought before the trial, during the trial, I thought I need to put a website together. And I realized I have to do it fairly soon because the experience being a high profile case and having so much criticism, it would be easy for me to say, I just don't want to come out in public again. I'm going to go live in a cabin in the woods and forget I, you know, was born. So I thought that this was actually for my healing as well as the healing of others to keep going. And I thought one thing is missing is getting information out there. So I made sure the site was up and running, but it's just not, it's not where I want it to be. It's just starting. So it's only been a couple of weeks, but I'm planning on having a forum there where people can speak and it'll be moderated. And I want a guide on testifying under cross-examination. That's like huge on my list. So somebody just needing something, who hasn't got any advice from anyone, they can get the idea of what it means to make a proper police statement and things like that. Just information and read stories of other people. I realize there's a lot of people out there with a lot of pain, and there's people out there with similar issues with the police, and, you know, people, some people, they don't even tell them the charges were dropped and the restraining order's off. You know, I wasn't told that Gian Gomeshi's bail conditions were changed. I was given his bail, you know, the paper with all the conditions on it mailed to me, but then when they changed it, they didn't bother even telling me, right? And I just thought, as a witness, I had a right to know. So just things like that.
So where would you like to see your new web project a year from now?
Well, I have a lot of people who have been offering assistance, of doctors and people who give seminars on workplace sexual harassment. And I'm looking at it as a big collaboration with people. It's not just going to be about me and my website. It's going to be a group of people who are coming on board and helping out for a very worthy cause. It's much needed, just giving information. I mean, I know there are sites out there for people who have, you know, need help and care, but I kind of want to get people before they step into court, and not necessarily a place where people are coming for counseling or anything like that, but information on court and the process and what was it like and how to survive it and all that. It's just somewhere to land and get information, resources. But in a year from now, I'm really excited because of all the people contacting me. I can see it turning into a really big project with lots of people on board. Everybody has something different that they're specializing in, and that we'll have resources for everybody.
Now, final question for you. You know, here we are on the other side of the judicial process, you know, and there's been ups and downs. Would you do it all again?
I wouldn't want to, but I would definitely do it all again. Like I said, there's nothing in it for me to go through court, but it's the right thing to do. And the reason I encourage people to keep coming forward, even though it is hard, I want them to come forward armed, because it cannot be something that gets swept under the carpet. It can't be a dirty little secret. People can't get away with sexual assault because they know that we won't speak because it's too difficult. We have to start speaking up and making noise and bringing it to everyone's attention, what the issues and the problems are. And then nothing will change if we don't speak up. And it's hard, but no change ever happens without having to go through the pain, right? And what I've just gone through, there's just no way that I'm going to take this and walk away. I'm fighting back.
On April 25th, 2016, it was announced that the Crown would not appeal Gian Gomeshi's acquittal after finding, in their own words, no legal basis to do so. Thank you to Linda Christina Redgrave for joining me for an interview. You can visit her website at comingforward.ca. This interview was hosted and produced by Rob Chernick at CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge, Alberta.